This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, the point of view of three capitals in Ukraine conflict. Kyiv, the Kyiv point of view. President Zelensky, much on the video, to different legislatures, presenting the case for more weapons, more support, faster, and making the case that NATO is not, at this point, keeping up with the supply necessary to hold off the Russian advance in Donbass. And worse, NATO is meeting in Madrid within these next days. President Biden will attend. The headline in the New York Times tells the story of concern. A new task for President Biden, says the headline, colon, readying allies for a long conflict in Ukraine. Subhead, in March, talk of victory was in the air. Now, comma, maintaining unity against President Vladimir Putin is looking harder, with President Biden heading to Germany and Spain to rally Europe. Professor, there was a rule that Churchill taught us during the Second War. When your leaders are standing next to your ruins, you're losing. When their leaders are standing next to their ruins, they're losing. Right now, we're losing. What can President Biden do about it at Madrid, if anything? And what does Kyiv need? What is Kyiv's point of view watching this discussion at a distance?
Well, I'm fascinated by the New York Times headline. That's unusual. I'm not a New York Times addict. But if you were to choose somebody to rally the NATO allies, would you choose Mr. Biden? Because he, after all, has gone from saying this man cannot remain in power just a few months ago. And remember, wars tend to go on longer. They don't end the way they do on TV after, you know, in an hour. He was saying that, you know, Putin must be out. Then we were talking about how Russia was going to be weakened and so forth, and now he's telling all of his various colleagues and subordinates, we must stop talking about victory and so forth and so on. And he appears to have made a decision, just as he made a decision to deny air power to the Ukrainians, which would have made a huge difference. He seems to have made a decision that we're not going to give them the artillery that they need, actually, to win. Now, I think the Ukrainians are well aware of this. What can they look to as alternatives? Because I don't think the Ukrainians are just going to sort of wipe their brows and say, well, that was a good game, but we lost. Let's go shake hands with the winner. The amount of bitterness that is now being released is extraordinary. And I might mention here that the Russians have torn down the flag at the site of the Katyn massacre carried out by the Soviets against the Poles, killing 22,000 Polish officers, really the core of a future Poland, in the spring of 1940. This is a unnecessary gesture, and needless to say, it's going to get the Poles mad as hell. So one of the things that the Ukrainians can say is, look, the Russians are thin on the ground. The reason they're deficient in many, many ways, but the reason that we're withdrawing is that they have concentrated what they've got in this Severodonetsk region, the Luhansk, this tiny crescent, the 700-mile front that we regularly see. But if they start, it's the concentration and the supply of weaponry that is giving them the advantage. Now, the Ukrainians have the advantage. They can do what Sun Tzu, the great Chinese strategist, said, attack that which is not defended. Because on this crescent, there are many, many points that are not defended. Kherson, for instance, is perhaps the best example, and they're apparently making headway at Kherson. They can also seek to set up basically an encirclement of a major Russian unit and concentrate their artillery against it and thus destroy it. Now, I would call this the Russian Dien Bien Phu, because we remember that in 1953, 54, the French established a very well thought out base in the far north of Vietnam. It was absolutely the platform for victory. But the Chinese communists gave to the Vietnamese heavy artillery that no one imagined could possibly be put into position, or would even be given. The Vietnamese took this stuff up into the mountains, and once it was in place, they were in a position to lob explosive shells right onto the French runway. In other words, they rendered Dien Bien Phu useless, and after a bitter fight, it surrendered on May 7th, 1954. So the Ukrainians may be able to design an operation in which they defeat a sufficiently important Russian unit as to cause another shift. They're also, I'm sure, looking for weapons from sources other than the United States. Poles have been found fighting in Ukraine. They have the question, they can attack lines of communication. There is the Crimea Bridge. They just took out 3 oil rigs. I don't know how you would take out the Crimea Bridge, but I think the Ukrainians are as good at that as the Russians are. Finally, if we look at it from the Ukrainian point of view, I think that we can say that the government is not going to surrender. It will be like if we want somebody to sign something, they'll find some nobody and send him or her to sign the thing. But the struggle will go on, and the estimates are that it was going to take 1 million Russian soldiers to subdue Ukraine. And do we have any idea how much hatred there is now between these two countries, which were basically speak the same language, they look the same, they share much of the same culture, they intermarried, and now a tremendous new hatred has been developed. And remember also that way back when, we were expecting the Ukrainians to lose, but then fight a guerrilla war, and we were getting our guerrilla specialists to advise them, and Mr. Zelensky just said, "Look, I don't need that. I need ammunition. I'm going to fight the Russians like an army." But I think the conclusion that Kyiv must make is that a clean victory by them is still possible, but it's not inevitable. The recent events have not made it that much less likely, but they certainly are bad news, particularly if we do not match what Russia is doing. So they can look into a future that I suspect contains lots of chaos, escalation, suffering, the ruins you were referring to people standing next to, but it's not going to include peace, and it's particularly not going to include the kind of peace that Mr. Blinken, Mr. Sullivan, and to the extent that he thinks about such things, Mr. Biden, have in mind. That's just a will-o'-the-wisp.
The refugees in the diaspora, Professor, are they refugees to return, or are they refugees to remain in the diaspora, similar to other broken nations over the last 100 years? Can you measure?
I think that's very hard to know. I think it depends on the outcome of the war. But after, we have a whole lot of very smart Hungarians in this country, and they're here because the Soviets crushed the Hungarian Revolution in 1957. We have well over 1 million Vietnamese who are making an immense contribution to our country, everywhere from better food in restaurants to better math and physics departments. And I have to say that perhaps the most important historian of the present generation in the United States is a woman of Vietnamese ancestry whose parents came over on a raft. But they're not going back to Vietnam because Vietnam is really doesn't belong to them. So if we want all of these Ukrainian refugees and they want to go home, the Russians have to be defeated. And then you can start cleaning up.
Professor H.J. McIntyre, International Relations, commenting on the point of view of Kyiv as we are on the eve of the NATO meeting. We're going to Brussels next, the capital of NATO, the capital of the EU. Brussels now is repairing what it can of the relations between memberships that are dissenting. For example, Turkey dissenting on new members, Finland and Sweden. For example, Hungary dissenting on assistance to Russia one day and then embracing Kyiv the next. Brussels next during the Ukraine conflict. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.